the end of the second big word describing what happened on Good Friday. We have been studying for about, this is the second year, I guess, we've been studying about what actually happened during those several hours that afternoon on the cross on Good Friday. There was a young Jewish man, 30, 35 years of age, perhaps as young as 28, at the earliest, was executed by the Roman government, and the crime, the New Testament tells us that the crime that was committed was put on a little placard and nailed above him on the cross, and his crime was for being the King of the Jews. And the Jewish leaders didn't like the title for a couple, any number of reasons. Pilate recognized that one of the prime motive problems was of envy. Jesus had rallied all the people around him because he was non-elitist. He would eat with anyone. He would fellowship with anyone. He would forgive anybody. He would go after the sheep that got caught in the brambles and leave the other 99 in the open field. He was always willing to reach into somebody's life, regardless of how acceptable they were to the status quo. He had a power. He was known as the heir. They understood who he was. They fully well knew who he was. And they objected to that title for that reason. The Romans, of course, liked doing it because it was an anti-Semitic gesture. The Roman government and the Roman soldiers had a very despising view of the Jewish people of the time, and many of their conquered nations, including the Jews, of course, they looked down upon them. And Jews had been singled out, of course, through much of history for a particular opposition and persecution, and the Romans took particular delight in executing the King of the Jews. And so when they mocked him, remember, in the trials and mocked him in the pre-crucifixion proceedings, you know, they put the robe on him, right, and the crown of thorns and all of this, and it was an animosity. And it was a foreign nation animosity against God's people of the Old Testament. And when we look into, as we look into what happened during that execution, on that crucifixion, we found that what looked like an act of supreme defeat on the part of Jesus of Nazareth, of the King of the Jews, of God's Messiah, God's anointed one, the very Son of Man who was to come in the clouds with power, Daniel, the image, when that powerful figure in Old Testament history, when all of a sudden this individual was nailed to the cross and crucified, needless to say, it was difficult to reconcile that with what the Jews understood their Messiah was going to be like. Now, half of the Jews, the half that, and remember, I never use these fractions correct, but part of the Jews, okay, understood that their Messiah was also there in Isaiah 53. They understood that there was going to be a suffering Messiah. They understood that there was going to be a betrayed Messiah from Zechariah. They understood. They just couldn't put that together, how we were going to get an humble Messiah come in on a donkey and at the same time ride in on a white horse, fly in on a white horse in clouds and smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. So they weren't sure how to put those two together theologically. And so sometimes, depending upon how bad it was, how bad they were persecuted by the nations around them, they would dream for the latter. They would dream for redemption from foreign oppression, Old Testament categories. And this was quite a shock to the system. The disciples, if you remember, Jesus consistently told his disciples, once they finally got the clue that he was the Messiah, he had gone through all these things the first couple of years. He had done these various little signs and miracles. And he always did his miracles, what we call, below radar. Because it wasn't supposed to be that kind of a ministry. It was just supposed to be when he would go out and he would do a healing, or he would do an exorcism, or he would do a nature miracle. It was not supposed to be proof that the kingdom was there, or proof that he was the Messiah, or proof that the kingdom was near. It was supposed to be the kingdom itself. That's what that was. Where that act of liberation and freedom and healing and freedom from bondage and insight and change of life, that was what the kingdom was. That's what the kingdom is. And he was just doing little microcosms, little pockets of that which is apolutro, way out there. He was doing pockets to say, this is what it's like. This is what it's like. This is what it's like. Okay? And they weren't just sort of, you know, the samples at the end of the grocery aisle where you eat one little piece of sausage and then they want you to buy more. No, this was the real thing, the full boat right there. And in those lives that were continually transformed. The difference between the extreme cases, the demoniacs in the cemeteries that had paranormal physical power, could break chains. Okay? The difference between that and after Christ popped in there, had an encounter, and all of a sudden they're clothed, sitting quiet, and in their, I love the phrase, in their right mind. In their right mind. Okay? See, they're right brain thinkers. Yeah. They were in their right mind, right? And that was what the kingdom was, complete freedom, renewal, being more who you were supposed to be, more authentic you, right? And so the kingdom was expressed this way. And then as soon as they got that idea, when he asked, he's outside of Israel, he's up north in Israel, up north of Israel, he's in pagan country, and he asked his disciples, who do the people think I am? Some say John the Baptist, some say the prophet. It's interesting that all their responses are people that were being raised from the dead. In other words, they don't say just a regular prophet, but a prophet of the Old Testament that's come back to life, or John the Baptist that's come back from the life, or Elijah that's come from heaven. Okay? In other words, the things that they did were beyond what a normal person would have done. So you had to come up with bigger guesses as to how this kind of power could be manifested in the life of just this one common person from Nazareth, a despised town in Galilee, a despised region of a despised country. Okay? And so once he goes, what do they think? And then what do you think? So he asked Peter, who do you say I am? Right? All the theological disputations you can read about, he will always come and ask you what you think. He will always ask you how you relate to him. It doesn't matter what the teacher says or the tapes say or the books say. You will always get grilled individually in times of crisis or in times of peace or in times of soul-searching as to who you say he is, right? And so he came up with, you are the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. This is to come into the world. He doesn't actually say who is to come in the world. The fuller theological explanation of that was given by the woman. If you think Mary and Martha in the Gospel, when Jesus asked her one time, makes some kind of comment, she comes up with the same confession that Peter does, except she has one more level of theological subtlety. She understands that it was supposed to come in the world, the pre-existence. She was just a little smarter, probably, than Peter. And so, once that is stated, he says, okay, you got that? Got it. You now know, you're convinced I'm the Son of God? Yes. You're convinced I'm the Messiah? Yes. Okay. I'm an anointed one? Right. I'm that powerful figure? Yes. Okay. Now let's go die in Jerusalem. Now that we've got this, I couldn't tell you this ahead of time because you would never have said you're the Messiah if I had started saying from day one, we're going to go be crucified. You never would have mapped me over into those categories of Messiah. But now that you've got that from these other reasons, now I can say what a real Messiah does. A real Messiah lays down his life for his people, right? A real Messiah goes all the way, takes up his cross. A real Messiah loves that far, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have got it. You would have just put me over to some military figure that would have blown the Romans away with a sword in my mouth, right? But now that you got it, okay, this is the way we conquer everything. We go to the cross. And they argue with him, and he has that confrontation. Remember, Peter says, no, don't talk this way. You're going to demoralize the disciples. Remember, Peter takes Jesus aside, right? this is great coaching. he's going to be a political mentor to Jesus, right? Takes him aside. No, we've got to tone this down. We've got to spin this a little differently, Jesus. Your troops are going to be discouraged, demoralized to think that you're just charging off into this death. And before Jesus actually responds and uses that great Jewish, Satan, get behind me, it says he turned and he looked at his disciples before he even said that. Peter, you know, he considered what was important that they understand about why we do what we do, what priorities exist. The main thing is obedience and commitment to the prime relationship in our lives. And so they go through this, they go to the cross, and they go through this, and this is declared in the New Testament to be the victory of God over everything. Everything. Okay? And what we've been studying are the different words that were attached to that when God would stand back and say, now you see that? Here's the way I see that. I used the word sacrifice to describe that, and we talked a whole year about what that meant. And this year we've been talking about redemption. If I get invited back next time, we will talk about reconciliation. Okay, and we'll keep going until we get through the 32 words that are used to describe this. It's 32 different words and images. Okay. Actually, I haven't done those syllabuses, so I'm hoping that the Lord will come before then, and so we can have a more visual experience of that rather than us have to do this on this side of that experience. Now, we have gone through the New Testament in this section, and we've found three basic words that were used for the word redemption. And remember, the pop quiz I always give you is that whenever you talk about the word lutro, what's the first question that comes up in your mind? How much? Remember, it was ransom. It was ransoming somebody out of adverse situations. And the first question when somebody says lutro, you say, how much money are we talking here? How much money are we talking, right? And there were three words. There was lutro and a couple like it. Agorazo and that other word. Periousios, right? Okay. And lutro had an emphasis upon what? Freedom. Remember, you would lutro a servant, and they would be a free citizen of Rome, right? So it was freedom and from control and equality of status and things of this type. The second word, agorazo, from the word agora, okay, had not an emphasis on freedom, but an emphasis on what? Responsibility. Basically, they all had an emphasis on price. For those of you who said price, you got it right. That was correct. Okay, but whereas lutro was somebody freed and become a voting citizen and a member of a full-fledged citizen in the empire, in agorazo it was a change of owner. You just moved to a better owner. Okay, and therefore, and your status as a servant was always related, of course, to the status of your master or your owner. So if you were a butler in England, if you were a butler to the monarch, to the king of England, back 150 years ago, that was one of the highest positions of honor you could possibly have in the country. To be picked for that kind of service, see, was an awesome status. You were, from a social standpoint, you were higher than most normal folk because you were a servant of the king. You were a servant of the king. You were in charge. The king trusted you with their resources, which were the resources of the nation in those days, right? And so agorazo involves a change of ownership, and the emphasis now is upon responsibility, significance of that responsibility, importance, the fact that you are marked out with something to accomplish in life. You have something that God wants you to do. And something doesn't mean something big. He normally means lots and lots of something littles. Because the way this thing worked, if you look at the ministry of Jesus, he just didn't do one big miracle. No, he went to all the little villages. He talked to all the little people. He did thousands and thousands of little bitty transactions, little bitty kingdom kinds of things. Encouragement, love, confrontation, challenge, insight, warmth, compassion, constantly going through this. And so agorazo had to do with our significance, a change of responsibility from a bad master to a great one that would invest in us educational resources, give us medical care, etc., those kinds of things. And the third one, this peri word, remember, had to do with treasured possession. The emphasis was upon how treasured we were to God. It was used in that, you will be to me a treasured possession, my special, a richness thing, right, to me. And so there was a specialness of that, of our relationship with God. And that's the New Testament flavor. And what we want to do today on page 22 is do a brief contrast of redemption in the New Testament, what we've been talking about the last several months, with what we talked about in the fall, redemption in the Old Testament, to see how the concept changed, grew, or developed, or how it's different in our world as opposed to before the time of Christ. So I've got this comparison and contrast chart to take you through. And so, redemption in the Old Testament, item one, was based on a solidarity with the tribe. In other words, I got redeemed because I was of the tribe of Benjamin. In my family, if I got in trouble, remember, I used the example, if I got too far behind in my bills and I had to sell myself to make ends meet to somebody, my brother, who was charging consulting rates as opposed to just temp labor rates, would come over and could buy me out of that situation and bring me home. Could bring me home, right? And so my being redeemed was a function of me being already a part of that tribe or that family. That's how redemption worked. In the New Testament, of course, it's everybody, solidarity with everybody. Jesus goes after every child of Adam. Every child of Adam. The solidarity, if you think about the passages when Paul is contrasting Jesus with other, he never contrasts Jesus with Abraham. It's always with Adam. The big ones are with Adam. Because he didn't just come to do one group. He came to do, and when we get to reconciliation, we'll see how big this scope was. But here it's just solidarity. If you qualify here. In the Old Testament, it might say, well, I'm outside of Israel, therefore I'm not subject to the Goel redemption thing. Here, all you got to do is produce a scrap of human DNA, and you're in. You're in. Even close enough. I imagine there's lots of flex for us on that, but just enough to demonstrate that we have some level of humanity in us. And Jesus says, yep, they're included in this deal. They're included in this deal. I can go for them. The second one was, the second point of contrast, or comparison. The Old Testament, of course, this was done for family. You would go and you would do family. Remember, my brother did not have to redeem me at all. And if I was a particularly obnoxious older brother, he might take his time in doing this and maybe wait till a day before that Sabbath year when I was going to go free anyway, so that he could say, you know, I still did it, Glenn. I still did it. It just took me a little longer, right? It was done for the family. In the New Testament, it's done for enemies. It's done while we were yet enemies, Christ died for us. Right? See, this is that experience that we have in the New Testament of being shocked by grace. Just shocked. You don't expect God to do this in your life. You don't expect. I remember the first time He switched on me of disciplining me from with adversity, trials and stuff, to discipline me with acts of goodness. The shaming kind. The kind that just really blow you. I remember, I was on a stairwell. I was in college. And I was just, it was probably the worst time of my life up to that point. This is 25 years ago. There have been other times since then. And I was just grumbling about something in my heart. I was just out of it. Just, you know, I was in the wilderness mode. It was mealy mouth, you know, just murmuring, grumbling. And I was hurting financially at the time. I've just started Bible college. Somebody came and gave me an announcement that some anonymous donor had given me a little scholarship to pay on my school bill, right? And, of course, the world changed after that, right? Because right there I realized, oh, no. See, this isn't like the spanking that you can be sullen about. You know, this is different. This is different. And so since that time, he's learned that that's very effective on me. And I try not to get in those situations, but that's the kind of thing that occurs here. This is where I didn't expect it. I was trapped. I was caught. I was fighting God, and yet the hound of heaven chased me down, right? And so this is done for enemies. Three, the enemies of the Old Testament that one would be redeemed from were visible. They were often very human. They were sporadic. In other words, they would come with wave of military attack, or they would come with famine, or they would come with those kinds of things. And they were always very powerful. They would overpower you. They would capture you like a military victor and carry you off. You'd be a prisoner of war. In the New Testament, the enemies are invisible. These are things I can't see in my heart. You know, I can't see some of this stuff. I can see how it works. But some of this stuff I can't even understand in Western civilization, how macro forces, how we can have malignant intelligences that are called angels. You know, it makes perfect sense, but man, I just can't, you know, because I can't see it, it's tough in Western civ. And I don't understand how all this stuff works. But they are constant. They are constant with me. Okay, these things are always around inside. The heart is desperately wicked and incurably ill. Jeremiah said, it's always there. and they are more powerful than humans could ever hope to be, because they're very subtle. I think about the Roman soldiers that would have been standing around the time of Christ, right? So when Jesus is talking about, if the Son sets you free, you'd be free indeed. You know, that would have been within, 100 meters of a Roman occupation force, that was the most powerful military, because they were better organized than any other nation up until that time, and they had the best military force. Very powerful enemies of Judea, let's put it that way. Okay? And when he would say, let me show you how to defeat a Roman soldier, when they require you to carry the pack a mile, you offer to carry it 2 miles. You say, that pack does look heavy. I know it's tough. I know you don't have a lot of choices. And why don't you let me carry it just one more mile for you? God would do the same thing for me if I were in your shoes. So let me just do it one more mile for you. See, that would kill a Roman soldier's heart. See what I'm saying? They would never be the same with that thing. We'll get more into that when we get into reconciliation. But God is going to win this through peace and love. The things that you just can't, it's difficult to say no to. It's just difficult. We can, but we a lot of times we don't. 4, Old Testament redemption always had an avenging. Remember, there was an avenger. There was an avenger of blood we looked at. It was a specialty case. And this is where I would redeem your reputation, that you weren't under a curse. Remember, we've talked a couple of times that in the Old Testament, if you died prematurely or you experienced adversity in Israel, it was a sign that you were under a curse by God. That's the way Deuteronomy was set up, and that's the way the system was supposed to work. So if I'm out in the field and some murderer swings by and I get, on that oxen cart, I'm a victim of a drive-by shooting or something, right? And I die in the field prematurely, guess what the whole society is going to decide about me and my family? We're under a curse of God. We're under a curse of God. And guess who's not going to do good to my widow and my kids? The society. Everything is in jeopardy because I am slandered in this particular case. And so the avenger of blood was supposed to bring me, go out there and get, not me, but my attacker, and bring them out to justice, bring them to the tribunal, and so that there could be an inquiry, and they could use the Urim and Thummim in some cases to decide that, no, Glenn wasn't under a curse. Somebody else was malicious. See? And that was avenging my reputation and redeeming my family in that particular case from the consequences of an oppressor or treachery. Okay? So vengeance in the Old Testament was immediate. In the New Testament, all of that's postponed. Redemption had that as a component in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, when Jesus quotes passages, that have redemption in them, he stops at the verse that has vengeance. When John the Baptist, sends his disciples, John the Baptist is in jail, and he's in jail. The Messiah is walking around free, but he's in jail. This military overthrow is just not happening. So let's see if this is the right Messiah. He sends his disciples and says, are you the one that was to come, or should we expect somebody else? This is not going the way I sort of thought this was going to happen. I'm waiting any day to the rescue here. I'm here in the jail cell. And Jesus then quotes these passages from Isaiah 6, and he quotes, he said, the poor have the gospel preached to them, the sick are healed, etc. And he quotes this passage, and he leaves off the second half of the last verse. The first one is the day of redemption, and the second is the day of vengeance of our God. He stops the quote right there. Boom. You have this separation between the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse that we are in right now. That vengeance. And vengeance is nothing more than restructuring, if you will. It restructures reality back to where it's supposed to be. That reversal. That's where the poor get their land back from the oppressors that took it from them, in the case of Israel. Okay? Wrath and vengeance is basically restructuring action on the part of the monarch, the ruler, to set things back where they were supposed to be, the blessings. Okay? Well, we have this thing, vengeance has been postponed to the point that God gets slandered by this. Remember? Even in Peter, it says, where is the sign of his coming? Nothing's changing. He's not busting us wicked or prosper, etc., because vengeance is not swift. God's not even up there. And so people slam God, a problem of evil and suffering. Why doesn't God do something about this stuff? Right? Which would put all of us, stop us from being objectors, because it would all fall on us, clearly. There'd be nobody left to object. It'd be a shortcut to the solution. But his heart is different. His heart is different. Vengeance is all postponed. He's giving as many as possible a chance to come to him and change that, participate in the kingdom. Five, the Old Testament redemption often involved overpowering. God's holy arm would go out against Pharaoh's holy arm, and he would overpower. All right, he would overpower them with even in Assyria, early cases of Assyria. The angels would fight. There'd be plagues. God would fight. He would literally fight. Involved overpowering. In the New Testament, it generally involves substitution. Whoa! What? What a shift. See, redemption in the New Testament keeps saying the way we're redeemed is somebody takes our place under the oppressor, as opposed to the oppressor is crushed themselves. So now you have to ask, how powerful is substitution? Something else is at work here. Something else is bigger, deeper, stronger than just the oppressor. There are forces, something. There's influences, something. There are macro things at issue that we little hobbits don't see down here in the Shire. We just don't see that stuff out there. Six, the Old Testament, redemption was often not explicit as to price. Sometimes it didn't even mention it. You can see it. Remember, we walked through those exercises. What was paid? Who is it from? We gave this little thing. And sometimes price wasn't very explicit. In the New Testament, it's almost always explicit. I mean, if you look back through the little spreadsheets on that price column, it's almost always filled in. It's almost always filled in or clear from the context that it was a price paid. Seven, the Old Testament, the emphasis was upon the agent and the result. Who was the one doing the redeeming and what was the result? I went back home. I got free. I got brought back to Israel. And who it was? It was God. It was my family or somebody of that type. In the New Testament, the emphasis is upon the agent as a price. See, the emphasis is about Christ giving himself as a ransom for many. See, the emphasis is complete. It's still an agent of redemption. Still that powerful figure. But because of that notion of substitution, it's so clear that the agent is the price. In the Old Testament, the number eight, commitment and will of the agent. This is where the agent that goes redeeming overpowers through management will, as it would be called today. Executive will, overpowering, strength of commitment, things of this type. Whereas in the New Testament, it's the opposite. It's submission and the yieldedness of the price. He wins by not complaining about his detractors. He doesn't answer for himself at his trials. Doesn't fight back. Just he yields completely to God's judgment, and therefore is completely righteous. And the final point of contrast, the Old Testament, was the goal was return to the status quo. When I would get freed from selling myself into servanthood, I would just go home. Now, home may have been refurbished, but it was just generally home. Okay, return to the status quo. I go back to work. I go back to who I was and where I was before. In the New Testament, the goal is getting a share in Christ's inheritance. See, remember that agorazo meant I changed owners. I moved into somebody else's household. And all of the goodness of what was inside that household, I got to take advantage of. I got a part of that inheritance. And because of Lutro, I also get freed and adopted. So that I also get to be an heir of all that stuff. So all these things sort of work together. In the short term, I also get all the education and development things developmental investments that God makes because I'm a part of the household of God. There's a picture that's it's really beautiful. I don't know who does it, but it's a great picture. And it's, you got a snowy night, and you've seen these in the Christian bookstores, and you've got the banquet going on inside the thing. Jesus is at the door. You got the beggar outside on his knees. And Jesus is inviting him in there. And the beggar says, that's so different than the Old Testament redemption, if you will. The Old Testament redemption is a point of departure. It's beautiful. It's good. It's going home. But when you get to walk into that warm banquet that wasn't at home, you know, compared to our New Testament experiences, it's so much bigger. Redemption is so much bigger because it's to the enemies. It's to us that are out in the highways and the hedges that wouldn't make it otherwise. And so the New Testament redemption is, it changes focus. If you had to contrast that, the thing you'd have to say, the difference between the two is the love of Jesus. You know, when you think about it, when you look at those columns, the biggest thing was about, it's about Jesus, how that was done, and why that was done. It was out of a love for the unlovely, love for those that had no claim upon him. See, I could complain about my brother in the Old Testament. My bill wouldn't come help me out. I don't care how busy he was or how busy his travel schedule was for his company. He should still come bail me out. See, I had some level of claim on that. See, but when I have been an enemy of God or apathetic, couldn't care less or whatever, or playing my own God, I got no claims on Jesus. I got no claims on Jesus. So when he shows up at my dungeon, speaks that word, doors open, flames with light, chains fall off and says, come get in the limo, we're going to the castle. I say, are you talking about somebody else? Is there somebody else in here that you're talking to? Is this a case of mistaken identity? No mistake. No mistake. Okay, so let's go to page 23. The difference was the love of Jesus, as it always is. Now, our concluding observations have to do with what we've been studying about this session, about redemption in the New Testament. And I'm just going to go through these. There's 19 of these. I don't have to make a lot of comments about these because I want to talk just a minute or two about reconciliation at the end if we can. So, and some of these, a lot of these are review of the summary points that we've been talking about. So the first one is, over biblical history, the Old Testament and the New Testament, it became apparent that our greatest enemies were somehow inside us. Our very selves stopped us from invoking God into our personal histories more. All right? Pretty clear. In other words, we no longer point the Flip Wilson, the devil made me do it. By the time we get to the New Testament, we don't need his help. We don't need his help. Okay, we got enough problem with stuff at home. We got enough problem when the Apostle Paul can say, I hate this. The good that I want to do, I can't do. And that which I don't want to do, I do. God, I hate this. And he says, and it's going to be this way because Galatians 5 said they are warring. It's a constant fight. Constant fight. And we're caught in a crossfire. You know, it's going on. All this stuff is going on. And that's where the problem is in us. Like I say, I mean, we don't need a lot of help. Although we do get a lot of help, you know, because sometimes we pool our resources and our tendencies, and but our very selves stop us from asking God to help us more, to open up more to God. That's the biggest bottleneck in our lives. I think we would draw more fire if we did that more. Let's put it this way. If we did that more, we just spent 5 more minutes with God, honestly, without the grocery list. You know, just saying, here's the way I'm feeling today, and I don't know where I stand. Whatever is on your heart. 5 more minutes. 2, but there are macro forces as well as just the stuff inside us, supernatural influences that work in our history. There are things that are bigger than us. I don't understand how this works, but it produces societies such as ours. It produces cultures like ours with the abuses and the goodness and the badness within it. Somehow they do it. Things always seem to run downhill. You know, I don't know why. We always complain decade after decade that things just, you know, it's getting worse. And you can go back to 3000 BC, and in their little journals, they're saying things are getting worse. It's always getting worse. I remember going to a film one time, a long time ago. I was just graduating grad school. It was in Atlanta, Georgia. Carter was governor of the state back then. Okay, I went it was in huge inflation crisis. This was like 72 inflation crisis. And the opening film was a quote that said, prices have gotten so high nowadays, the price of a loaf of bread is out of reach of the normal person. They keep going up. I don't see how we're going to be able to live. And the quote was from Martin Luther. I thought, wait a minute, wait a minute. I thought I had the right to complain about it. It's not fair. I've been trivialized by all of history. There are macro forces that work, and we don't know enough about them, but you always have to watch. You just have to pay attention in advertising, the messages that, you know, that come across the media for good or ill, from your friends and things of this type. There are macro forces. 3, The subtlety of these harsh masters that we've been talking about makes it even worse. They sometimes are disguised as goodness. And these masters are deceitful, a la the garden, with promises of life and fulfillment. There's a passage in the New Testament that says, lest your hearts be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. And when we decide to be gods and push God out for pockets of time in our lives, that's called what the Bible calls sin or wickedness or the various older terms that it uses for that. But what happens there is that it deceives us into a heart. We get this kind of sense of power when we do it. But what it does is cauterizes us a little. It bakes our heart a little, makes us a little less sensitive to the moral nuance and moral call, makes us a little harder to respond that next time to goodness and compassion. And that hardens us because it's deceitful. It promises us, oh yeah, you take a bite of this thing, you'll be wise, you'll be a God, blah, 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 blah. Look at all this stuff that you get for free, okay, just by taking matters into your own hands here and disobeying God. They promise us life and fulfillment, and therefore these masters that are harsh, okay, are deceitful. And therefore, that's what they promise us, all this good stuff, right? There's some Christian song that was so great. It said one of the tricks that gets played on us is to get us to nostalgize about times that were actually hard in our life, that were bad on us. We look back to our pre-Christian days or whatever, and we talk about fun. And, you know, some people will nostalgize for those that had fun back in those days. That we'll look at that and forget that they were the worst times, the most abusive of their life, the most, you know, worthless, just worthless times, and nothing to show for it, nothing to show for it. Four, the internal oppressors wear us down as well and reduce our ability and willingness to seek help or freedom. So the battles within us, they wear our strength down. When we keep fighting with it, we don't draw strength every day with God and say, look, I need help. I'm in trouble today, or I'm weaker. I feel weaker today than I did yesterday, or I feel strong today, therefore I need help. I've got this illusion of strength here today. I need to stay close today because, you know, this is the brave sheep that's going to go charge the wolves, you know, because it's feeling very bloated because it hadn't sheared off the wool recently, so it's going to scare it with its impressive size, right? Yeah, right, you know. They wear us down. They reduce our ability and our willingness to seek help or freedom. Sometimes we just despair. It wears us down and we stop hoping. We get discouraged, we fall. We get up, we're encouraged, we fall. We get up, we're encouraged, we fall. And then we just say, why get up? Why get up? I'm just going to fall again. The righteous falls seven times but gets back up again. That's what Proverbs said. So, and seven is that word for completion. You just keep on it because you can outrun it. Because of that spirit spiral that we've talked about any number of times. See, the people that get discouraged about their Christian life, that they are not experiencing freedom, guess what is a sign of freedom? When you get discouraged, when you realize it. It's when you're complacent, you're satisfied with it, right? Everything's going well, and you don't see it, that you are in danger. It's when you say, I fell again, I have not done what I should have done, and I have done those things that I ought not to have done, and I have not gone where I needed to go, Lord, in my life, and I'm concerned about it. I'm backsliding. I'm apathetic. I'm worried about this kind of stuff. That's a sign of freedom because you didn't get that otherwise. That's somebody sitting there saying, the spirit, your conscience, your heart, saying, okay, be aware. Just let's go to work on it. You got a problem? We're not going to analyze it to death, but we're just going to keep moving. That's a sign of freedom, sign of freedom. Redemption, Lutron, focused on the release of slaves, often captured in wartime, are innocent victims of piracy. We talked a lot about them. Six, slavery in new times, although vastly different from New World slavery, was not seen as something to be sought, except as a means to a better life in the future. Remember we talked about those people that would sell themselves into servanthood, right, to rise politically and to get Roman citizenship. Its badness varied with the badness of the master. So if you had the harsh taskmasters that we have in the New Testament, it's not a good place to be. It's not a good place to be. Seven, there are many forces in our lives that seem to attempt to subjugate us to their agendas. Now, this is a big one. You've got these in your life. You look at, and this is something worth reviewing on a periodic basis, where you sit there and saying, what things in my life, what pressures, work, family, friends, personal, psychological baggage from childhood, whatever, what kind of forces are trying to apparently have an agenda for my life? They have some place they want me to go. They want me to be a whiner. Do they want me to be a victim? Do they want me to be arrogant and cold-hearted toward others? Do they want me to be triumphant to the point of elitism? What are their agendas? If I follow it, where does it go? And how close does that match Jesus the week before he died? Map it over into that. Measure it by that kind of standard. Many forces in our lives, and you need to review. That's part of that insight. Ask God for the wisdom. He gives that. 8, the redemption effected by Jesus was via his offering of himself as a ransom. This is crystal clear. There are many things that Jesus did on the cross that we've been studying and will study. But one of the clearest was that he was a ransom. It was considered a ransom, explicitly. That substitute somehow was what unleashed all these forces in our lives. 9, the emphasis on the price paid in the New Testament is pervasive, and this differs a little from the Old Testament theme. Remember, the Old Testament gave us the visual, the metaphor to base it upon about relief from oppression and freedom. In the New Testament, we saw that applied into a much wider scale. 10, the Lutron picture involves ransoming a slave and then granting him or her their freedom. So the Lutron part of redemption had to do with freedom, complete freedom. 11, the Apolutron, remember Lutron with that extra little piece on the front, Apolutron picture focuses on the final and full liberation of the child of God. All oppressive situations and relationships are not released in history now. Compare Paul's thorn in the flesh. He prayed 3 times. God said, that's enough. You're going to do it. We're going to live this way for a while. But the ability to persevere the worst and transform many of them into softer situations is part of the present freedom. Paul could take a thorn in the flesh and sit there and with a proper perspective turn it into a power for God. He could sit there and say, okay, you said strength is made perfect in weakness. You gave me this weakness. That means instead of just living in the weakness, if you know what you're talking about, there's got to be some way to be strong through this thing. Not just in it, but through it. Somehow you'll bless me more on the days I feel sick and the days that I feel the weakest and the days that I cry out, I can't do this. You know, this. I'm going to mess this up, God, if you let me go ahead with this. Okay? The ability to persevere the worst and transform it. The flow of love and acceptance of others that is supposed to flow from the new heart of believers is supposed to be a microcosm of what the new universe will be like. See, the way you talk to one another before this hour and after this hour is supposed to be what heaven's like. The way you greet one another. And I've seen this in your lives the past couple of years that has so impressed me. I have seen love here that have, for the first time in my Christian life, I've sat there and say, now I understand about why the bride of Christ is beautiful to him. Because you can see that beauty sometimes in the way you smile at one another, and the way you hug one another, and the way you greet one another, and you grieve for one another. You can see something there that's, I use that word, incandescently beautiful. And I can see now glimpses of what he sees in his church. And I can see that love, and I can see why he's proud. And he brags and gets us in trouble sometimes by bragging, Job, right, as a church, right? And that's what that's supposed to be like. 12, a freed slave was not without obligations to his or her former owner. There were expectations of personal interaction and response. Remember, the word was gratitude. There was supposed to be a respect and a gratitude if someone freed. 13, the agorazo picture emphasized the price paid and the change of ownership. The believer is a member now of the household of God with responsibilities and therefore has a new status and a new significance in their life. A new significance. Right? They now are supposed to help the others around them in the household. A lot of the household servants just ministered to other household servants. So you would have a household physician, for example, that was a servant. Most of the physicians in the Roman Empire were servants, actually. That was responsible also for the upkeep of everybody in the household, from the lowest servant to the master. See? And so it was all, and there were barbers, and there were musicians, and there were cooks, and all this, and everybody ministered to one another in this, regardless of social class in the household, in the Roman household, the pater familias. 14, this picture of slavery is one of enhanced status, responsibility, and opportunity. Remember, education costs and development costs were the responsibility of the owner, master, culminating in full adoption. 15, the major differences in material situations of slaves derive from the owner's character and status, in other words, how nice the person that owns the household is, and the slave's responses. If you look at some of the stories of Jesus, you know, it's the ones that exploit the master or think evil of the master and that go, you know, said, "You are a harsh master, I'm going to go bury your talent," instead of somebody that invests the money, the 5 or the 10 talents, and then gets shared in the blessings, right? The differences of how I respond can affect how I get treated and what my opportunities for growth are. If I say no to God consistently for 10 years, I'm going to miss 10 years of growth. 16, the parapoemi picture shows us the heart of God toward those He paid this dear price for. He sees us as a treasure all His own. Now that's a little unfathomable, but as I encouraged you last week, I hope you thought about that for 2 to 3 minutes this week. Well, you sit there and say, am I really cherished that much? That feels good if you can step into it long enough to feel that as opposed to just say it. 17, the loosing and freedom passages also point out the peaceful place in which we stand. We are no longer bound to religious systems and obligations and requirements for self-improvement. We don't have to get better to go to the doctor. We go to the doctor when we're sick. You ain't got to get better to go to the doctor. Sometimes we clean the house before the housekeepers come. That's a different issue altogether. Instead, we stand in free acceptance, aggressive affirmation, full pardon, with no barriers whatsoever to exploring a full relationship with the God of life and love. He pardons ignorance on the part of toddlers, just like we do. Just charge in there and love God. Just, hey, I want more. I want to know you more. I don't know what I'm even asking for, God. But I want to be closer to you. I want to be more like your son. 18. This release from bondage occurs in our hearts via the Spirit that works in our life, in our relationships with other believers via the Lord of the church, and in our relationship with the wider created order via the Father. Enjoyment of nature, for example. I got this sweet email when I was in Australia. We were in the Blue Mountains of Australia. Just gorgeous. It looks like the Grand Canyon filled with trees. And I did an email to my daughter who was in Philly, and was told her about how beautiful this was. And that made me tear up. It was just so beautiful. It was just, you know, it's a crying, weeping kind of thing. And so she wrote back and she said, you know, you need to go to beautiful places more often, because they are only truly savored by those with spiritual appetites and cleaner palates. So many people stand at the foot of Half Dome and worry about their insurance rates. She's a gifted writer. She is really good, you know. And I flash back, now did I ever take her to Half Dome when she was a kid and talk about insurance? You know, that's the first thing you flash on as a parent, you know. Was that me she's talking about? It's got to be. But there is a freedom when you realize that this is God's playground. And even though it's soiled, and even though it's messed up, and even it's going to have to be refurbished, when you sit there and look at a tulip, or you smell cinnamon, or you touch a babbling brook, the coolness of that, you sit there and say, that's something else. Where did you come up with that idea, God? This is great. God the artist. Finally, the New Testament greatly expands the scope of Old Testament redemption, enemies, beneficiaries, and duration, and reveals the amazing cost of this to our dear-hearted God. If you look at the emphasis in the New Testament on the price and how awesome the price was, you're left with the conclusion that God's trying to get across to us the message of His love. You know, because the measure of His love is what He's willing to give for us. See, the level of sacrifice and commitment. When it's His only Son, it's the most precious, precious thing. His very heart. You sit there and say, first you always ask the question of mistaken identity again. But then you back up and say, if that is true, then why have I ever doubted you, God? Why have I ever doubted you? All the little ambiguous things in my life that I complain about and I fuss about and that do look adversarial and that do crush me at times, you know, why would I let that data count more as what about your heart than the data of what you did on the cross? what you gave on the cross, because you didn't have to do that. That's the clearest statement that I can find. Now, I want to give a quick recap of the two terms that we've talked about, and then what we're going to look at, Lord willing, next time we get together. Sacrifice had to do with repair and strengthening of life-giving and life-sustaining relationships. Remember, that was going to rebuild when relationships were broken with God or with fellows. Okay, you repaired those with an act of commitment. You went and you shared in faith. You either had a party with a sacrifice of your flock, or it was an act of giving back. Okay, it was a debt owed, and you tried to just do a token, like an apology would count. Apology never wrongs the right. I mean, right's the wrong. But it's always accepted sometimes. It's often accepted as a substitute therein, right? And what sacrifice focuses upon our need for love, loving relationships, affirming relationships, reliable, trustworthy relationships. You can't live without predictability in relationships. Remember, we are alone of the physical creatures are born completely helpless for the longest time, right? We require others to teach us. We can't go hunt and forage in 4 weeks like cats can, you know, or these kinds of things that are born with those skill sets. You know, some of us are still bumbling around late in life trying to find our way. You know, we're still trying to work on this. But sacrifice had to do with getting us to the place of loving and community relationships so that we could live, so we could get through life, grow, and develop. The one we've talked about this time, redemption, had two aspects. It had freedom from abusive relationships. The first one were life-giving and life-sustaining relationships. These are from abusive relationships where we need to get freed. Okay, so the emphasis there was upon freedom. And then in the New Testament, we also had an aspect that was restoration to a noble status in the kingdom of God. We're stewards. We're accountable. We're given resources to manage in our lives. And we're supposed to produce results in the lives of our families and our friends and those around us and our enemies. Okay, those kinds of things. Accountability and importance. And so if sacrifice dealt with our need for love and community, redemption deals with both our need for peace, that freedom from oppression, freedom and space, and the need for significance, importance of our responsibility before God as given a task in life. Reconciliation, which is the third word which we haven't gotten to, which is hopefully, like I say, we'll have, had to do with peacemaking. Reconciliation of enemies. It's when somebody is your enemy and you turn them into friends. When you turn them into a friend. This is reclaiming us in the fullest sense. Reclaiming others. Putting together relationships that are really, truly, not just broken, but hostile. But hostile. So, in the Beatitudes, when he says, blessed are the this, blessed are the that, etc., almost all of them conclude with, this is what you get. Blessed are those hunger and thirsters, you'll be filled. Blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the land. But there's one category where the blessing is the supreme thing. They shall be called the sons of God. And what group is that? The peacemakers. The peacemakers. And this is one of the things that you need to be aware of every moment of your life. My little gift, you know, is teaching. So I get up here and I do a one-hour spot. You know, and I write a lot and things of this type. But the thing that counts to God is, you know, the gifts of peacemaking, mercy, and these kinds of things, which is what we're all supposed to do. Some people actually have gifts of mercy, right? Counselors. You know, as far as I can tell, that's what a counselor is a gift of mercy. A gift of mercy. Also gifts of helps, but gift of mercy. But peacemaking is something you can do every day. Because there are always troubles everywhere around. There's always relationships that can be improved by adding just a little bit of peace, a little bit of kind word, a little waiting before you do the vengeance thing, another couple of minutes before you decide to do the vengeance, counting to 15 instead of 10, those kinds of things. But that is the kingdom eruption that he's trying to do. If God is going to reconcile enemies himself in the death of his son, that's in the fall maybe, you know, that's what we're supposed to be doing in the relationships of life, reconciliation, peacemakers, children of God. So I encourage you to take advantage of the fact that God is looking out for us for love, for peace, for significance, and then removal of enemies and an additional level of peace and shalom in our lives, to use the Old Testament phrase. So I want to thank you for your love for me over these years and encouragement and the gifts that you have given me in your hearts and your smiles. And I'd like us to close in a word of prayer.